Good morning. This is Larry Warren, and it's Monday morning, so that is time for Mountain Money, along with Doug Wells here, as usual. And Doug, a taste of winter this morning, a few minor little snow flurries.
A taste
in the
of winter,
air.
But boy, what a beautiful weekend it was!
Absolutely, got in maybe our final bike rides of the year, and now the snow guns are going, and we have ski season coming up in 2 weeks, hopefully, weather cooperating. We've got an interesting show this morning. First, we're going to talk with Scott Eblen. He's the author of the book Overworked and Overwhelmed, The Mindfulness Alternative. And who hasn't felt overworked recently in the last few years? So we will be talking about that with him.
And our second guest, Larry, we're going to talk baseball. And we're going to see if our audience can figure it out by the end of the interview. One of the two of us, you and I, one of the two of us is a baseball fan. The other one doesn't know much about baseball. So let's see if the audience can figure it out. Our second guest is going to be Tommy Tanzer. He is a former American baseball agent with the Major League, lives here in Park City as well, so that'll be interesting.
The real fan will be the one who knows the infield fly rule.
Okay, well, we'll go with that. I might be playing my hand early in the game. And then our last guest is going to be Green Hillman from Zupa's out at Kimball Junction. They've done a major menu change out there, and we're going to talk with Green about the changes there. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We have Scott Eblen on the phone with us. He's the co-founder and president of the Eblen Group, a professional development firm that supports executives and managers in exhibiting leadership presence by being fully present. He's an executive coach, speaker, and author. And welcome to Mountain Money, Scott.
Really pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have you. The book, Overworked and Overwhelmed. Is there anybody in America who doesn't feel that these days? And what's the what was the recipe that got us this way?
Yeah, you know, I think there are two big factors going on that leave so many people feeling overworked and overwhelmed these days. I think one began in 2008 with the financial crisis, and organizations had to figure out very quickly how to do more with less to survive, you know, in that environment. And what I've noticed in my work as an executive coach and a speaker to a lot of leaders is pretty much everybody's still in that mode, even though the economy has begun to recover. Unemployment's below 6% now, and there's a lot of indicators that suggest it's coming back, but I think organizations are still operating for the most part in that do more with less kind of environment. And one way I know that is when I ask people, are you working in the same job today that you were in a year ago, but the scope today on that job is a lot bigger than it was a year ago? Just about everybody says, yeah, that's the case. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is the iPhone, you know, and the Android phones and the smartphone connectivity, that computer that we're carrying around in our pocket that is masquerading as a phone, keeps us hyper-connected to our work. One study says for up to 72 hours a week, we're connected to our work if we have a smartphone. And there's only 168 hours in a week to begin with. You've got to sleep, eat, and bathe maybe for 56 of those hours, eight hours a day times 7 days a week. That only leaves you 40 hours a week to do everything else that you need to do in your life. So there's a lot of, you know, I think contributing factors to feeling overworked and overwhelmed.
So you mentioned a couple things since the recession of 2008, 2009. And, you know, when I was a kid, I remember my parents talking about how they felt overworked and overwhelmed. Do you think it's really different this time, or does it just feel different because we're now doing the jobs our parents used to do?
Yeah, that's hard to know, isn't it, right? Because you know, we're only living this particular life that we're living. You know, I think, you know, we know for sure that the technology's different, right? And one of the things that I've seen in my work over the last 5 or 6 years particularly, is whatever sense of boundaries that people have had in their lives about, you know, when I'm at work, I'm at work. When I'm not at work, I'm not at work. The smartphone connectivity has really caused that to just evaporate for a lot of people. And they've lost sight of boundaries in their life and allow themselves to constantly be on as far as work goes, right? And so they're always thinking about it, even if they're not actively working on it. And, you know, I can't speak for our parents' generation or our grandparents' generation, but I do think that the technology enables this generation to stay connected to their work much more than any other generation before them.
Well, why can't this generation just say no, in the words of Nancy Reagan, and turn off the cell phone when they go home?
Well, I think that's the thing. That's one of the things I'm suggesting in the work that I'm doing with people. There's an interesting study going on at Google right now. It's a study they're running of people, they call them Googlers, people who work at Google, and it's called GDNA, a little G for Google DNA. And they're doing this multi-year study of what makes people productive and effective and happy and so forth who work at Google. One of the early findings is that Googlers identify themselves in one of two big buckets. They're either segmenters or integrators. Segmenters, when they're at work, they're totally at work. They're totally on. When they're not at work, they're totally not at work. They're totally off. Integrators integrate. You know, they kind of check the stream throughout the day and throughout the week. Their research shows that the segmenters are more or less 100% happy. The integrators, about 50% of them are happy, and the other 50% aren't so happy. And so I think we can take a lesson from that, you know, and look for opportunities to segment it, you know, and to not pay attention to the work at certain times of the day, certain times of the week, maybe even entire weeks, right? You know, like when you're on vacation, then literally be out of the office, not one of those people who's checking your email, even though your notification says you're not available by email.
So that's a powerful finding you just shared with us, just the happiness quotient of people's mm-hmm. lives and versus being connected and not connected and taking time to get away from it all. You know, I am shocked that there's not a technological solution to help us. I mean, I think the first thing we need to admit is these smartphones are incredibly addictive. It triggers this gift mentality that we have. Everybody likes getting a gift. And I've done a little research on this myself. Just frankly, I'm addicted to my cell phone. And it triggers this part of your brain that's similar to when somebody gives you a gift. So you're looking for emails and it's just kind of, you know, somebody saying hello or whatever, it triggers that mechanism. So if it is so addictive, why do you think there's not a technological tool where you could say, I want access to my work email between these hours, but after that, I'm just locked out. Are there technology solutions available out there that we don't know about?
There actually are. Programs you can download that will shut you out of your email, you know, during certain hours of the day.
I want that app. Do you know a name or two of one or two of those programs?
You know, I don't have one on the tip of my tongue here, but if you, again, like so much in life, if you Google that, you'll just Google the idea, and I'm pretty sure you'll find a program for that. The other interesting thing, and this is really starting in Europe, companies like Daimler-Benz, the company that makes the Mercedes, they have instituted a company-wide policy now that email stops at 6 p.m. And if you send an email, it's not going to be delivered until, you know, 7 a.m. the next morning. I think it's Daimler-Benz. There might be another different European company. They have a policy now when you're on vacation, all the emails that are sent to you are deleted. So when you come back to your email on that Monday morning after being away, you have a zero inbox.
Boy, I would think that'd be dangerous. You'd miss some important memos along the way.
The culture though is if it's important, they'll write you back.
You know, I heard about that on NPR, and one of the shows interviewed some people from Mercedes-Benz that had come back, Larry, from vacation, and said, whatever happened to those deleted emails? And you know what? The reply was actually, it's intuitive. and interesting, and that is the people that needed to get a hold of them sent a second email when they got back from vacation. It sends out an email saying, we're deleting these emails. The person you're trying to reach is on vacation. I think it's a great idea.
Oh. Yeah, most of the American audiences I share that story with, oh my gosh, when can we start that? they desperately want it, right?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your solution to being overworked and overwhelmed, the mindfulness alternative. What are you suggesting we do to rewire ourselves?
Yeah, and that's an interesting way to describe it, is the rewiring. So if you're in that overworked and overwhelmed state, it's likely that you're in a chronic state of fight or flight, right? And we all know what fight or flight is. It's that, you know, emergency response system in our body when we're in physical threat. You know, we jump into action or we run away as fast as we can. Great for a saber-toothed tiger, not so great if you're trying to get through 200 emails a day and 6 or 7 meetings in the day and a bunch of different conversations. All of that input leaves people in a low-grade state of fight or flight, a chronic state of fight or flight. And the impact of that on your decision-making, your relationships, and your overall health and well-being, for sure, is just devastating. So everybody's heard of fight or flight. What I've learned, most people haven't heard of the body's opposite to fight or flight in your nervous system, and it's called rest and digest. It's the parasympathetic nervous system compared to the sympathetic nervous system from fight or flight. And you need both. Fight or flight, fight is your body's gas pedal. Rest and digest is the brakes. And they need to work in concert with each other. Just like you'd never drive a car and only use the gas, that would be like a recipe for disaster. You need to manage yourself so that fight or flight and rest and digest are working in play with each other. So when I talk about the mindfulness alternative, I'm not talking about meditating for an hour a day or doing, you know, 30 hours of yoga a week or whatever. What I've learned is that these different traditions of mindfulness that go back thousands of years all have the same effect, more or less, which is to activate your body's rest and digest response. And there are simple things you can do, like 3 deep breaths, for instance, or taking a 5-minute or 10-minute break to go for a walk. The rhythmic repetitive motion of the walk or the breathing activates the rest and digest response, and that helps keep you, you know, kind of in balance from a gas pedal and brakes sort of standpoint.
You know, we're lucky here, Scott, in Park City, because we, right through our back door, we have places we can go to kind of decompress and mm-hmm. reset things. A lot of people in the world aren't so fortunate to have the beauty we do outside. Your book talks a lot about, first you kind of lay out what the problem is, which we've talked about, and then your book gets into some of the solutions. And in particular, you talk about the importance of routines, having a positive physical routine, having a positive mental routine, and relationship routines. Mm-hmm. Why are routines so important? And give us a couple of your favorites from those categories.
Yeah, so I'll take the important part of the question first. One of my favorite quotes of all time is a line from Aristotle: "We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence then is not an act but a habit." And so I think that is a pretty nice way to explain why routines are so important. I'm asking 3 big questions in this book, related to a planning model that we use with our clients called the Life GPS. And the Life GPS turns on 3 big questions. First is, how are you when you're really at your best? When you know yourself to be in peak performance mode or really in the zone, what does that look like for you? And that, you know, the goal is to be there more often than not, right? And then the routines are the ones that help you show up at your best, right? You know, mental, physical, relational, and spiritual routines that enable you to show up at your best more often than not. What are those routines? That's the second big question. And then the third big question in the Life GPS is, great, so you're showing up at your best most of the time. What outcomes do you hope or expect to see in the 3 big arenas of life? Your life at home, your life at work, and your life in the community. And so I'm really trying to help the reader and my clients get clear, you know, with their answer to those 3 questions and identify simple routines that are relatively easy to do and likely to make a difference in them showing up at their best.
Now, you said, you know, it's not a matter of doing yoga 12 hours a week and a few other things like that, but you are a yoga coach. Talk a little bit about your journey, which began when you found you were facing severe physical disabilities.
Right, yeah. So in 2009, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and I was around 47, I guess 48 years old then. And I was really surprised by that because I thought I was in really great shape. Like everybody, I guess, I thought I was bulletproof. And I'd run a couple of marathons and all that. And very long story short, was that summer, I had a lot of ailments that I thought were running related. I went into the doctor to you know, basically have her do the easy fix, whatever that was going to be. And she had MRIs run, and the MRIs showed that I had multiple sclerosis. And literally within a month or two later, I could barely walk around the block. I had to drag myself up the stairs by the banister to get to bed at night because my legs wouldn't really work to get me up the stairs. It was kind of this whole body thing to get up. And I got worse and worse, frankly, in that next year and a half. And my wife, who loves me very much, and I'm very grateful for that, was looking for something that would help me. And she had read that yoga helps people with diseases like MS. And so I went to a yoga class that was close to our house and was really nervous because, like I said, my balance was terrible. I was really having trouble even walking. And I said to the teacher, said, look, you really need to keep an eye on me because this isn't going to go well. And she said, don't worry, we've had people like you before. And here's the deal. If you come here 3 days a week, it'll change your body. If you come here more than 3 days a week, it'll change your life. And so I chose the more than 3 days a week option. And she was right. That was a little over 4 years ago that evening. And since then, I've done hundreds of yoga classes and thousands of hours of yoga, and I'm a registered yoga teacher now. I regularly do handstands and headstands and all kinds of party tricks in yoga class, and it was the beginning of a path for me that really, when you have MS, you have to manage your stress, and if you don't manage your stress, you immediately feel it symptomatically in your body. And so I had to learn things to do to manage my stress better, mentally, physically, relationally, spiritually. And those are the routine areas that I'm talking about in the Life GPS. And they're not, I do go to yoga a lot. That's my thing. Everybody has their exercise thing. That's mine. But I'm not, you don't have to do that. I mean, there are lots of ways to manage your stress. But you have to be intentional about what it looks like and willing to take the little baby steps that will help you do that and help you show up at your best.
That's a incredible story. I'm sorry to hear about your diagnosis, and congratulations to you to finding something that's helpful. You know, I see a lot of parallels in yoga. I do yoga as well.
Uh-huh.
I see a lot of parallels in yoga in your book. Do you think your yoga practice influenced some of your thinking? For instance, you talk about the physical, the spiritual, and the mental in your book, and those are all important components to yoga. Did you always feel this way, or was the yoga a big influence on your book?
The Life GPS model and those four domains of routines, my wife and I came up with that for ourselves when we were young parents, 20 plus years ago. And so, I guess I've always had this kind of frame of mind, or, a sort of a self-improvement, know what you're trying to do, follow up on the plan, kind of approach to life. That's probably why I got into executive coaching. But the experience with yoga, I think, has probably helped me view it in a deeper way, or at least in a different way. And it's kind of broadened my perspective on the range of options that are out there.
Executive coaching is kind of a stressful job. The typical executive coach travels a lot, gives a lot of keynote addresses. It's one of the ways mm-hmm. you get the word out about your services. How have you adjusted kind of the typical job of being an executive coach to meet your current situation as well as your life outlook?
That's a fantastic question. Someone asked me about a month ago when the book first came out. She said, "Do you ever get overworked and overwhelmed?" I said, "Yeah, absolutely." we were just launching the new book when she asked me that question, and it's a very stressful experience to launch a new book, and while you're still trying to run a business with all the elements that you just mentioned. And the difference for me is I recognize it earlier now. When I begin to feel overworked and overwhelmed, because I have this biofeedback system called MS, in some ways it's an advantage for me, you know, because I recognize early, because my body tells me you're too stressed, and then I know what to do about it, you know, rather than sitting at my desk for another 30 or 40 minutes trying to grind a report out for a client and it's just not coming. I'll get up, you know, and I'll go for a walk and come back 10 minutes later, and 9 times out of 10 my mind is clear and I'm ready to go. And again, I'm just activating my rest and digest response when I go out for that walk. That's all I'm doing. So it's not really complicated. It's just being, the way I define mindfulness in the book is mindfulness equals awareness plus intention. You know, I have to be aware of what's going on around me and what's going on inside of me in terms of my response, you know, mentally, physically, and emotionally. And then once I'm aware, I can be intentional about what I'm going to do or not going to do next. And just breaking it down like that and recognizing that, you know, I don't have to solve for 100 things right now. I only really have to solve for one thing right now, you know, whatever that one thing is. That helps a lot, you know, in terms of managing the pace and kind of staying on the level.
Yeah, you know, we've had Daniel Pink on our show before on Mountain Money, and he writes of your book, if I had to choose one skill that could simultaneously bring greater happiness in life and more meaningful engagement at work, it would be simple mindfulness. There's a way out of the overwhelming busyness of modern life. And Scott Eplin has written the guidebook. So thanks for joining us this morning, Scott. The book, Overworked and Overwhelmed, The Mindfulness Alternative.
Scott, thanks. Go ahead, sorry.
Larry and Doug, thank you so much for having me. And great conversation with you. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. I enjoyed the conversation as well. One piece of one idea for you. Develop an app for all the stuff that's in your book. I think it would be really powerful.
Okay, that's a great idea. I'll take you up on that. Thank you, guys.
Okay, this is KPCW in Park City. We are headed to a high of 42 today. We've had our chance of snow, about a 30% chance. Now it's going to be clear for several days, but it's going to be low enough to be making snow every night. So we look forward to that. And chance of snow resumes on Wednesday night. Might be able to have more of the real stuff going. Okay, now we're going to have some fun. We're going to talk about baseball, being a baseball agent, show me the money, and all of that. We'll be back with Tommy Tanzer after this.
Hi, this is Bob Dillon, a lawyer in the Park City office of Jones Waldo with 38 years of legal experience in complex real estate transactions. Proud supporters of KPCW, Jones Waldo provides local businesses with legal services in areas ranging from real estate to employment law. Our website is joneswaldo.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In studio with us now is Tommy Tanzer. That sounds like a baseball name, Tommy. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So you've had some really interesting experiences, and I suspect there's a couple young people in the audience that would love to follow in your footsteps. You were an agent for Major League Baseball players. How did you get into that business?
Well, you started out as an agent for minor league baseball players and high school and college players, and I used to tell business people, financial, accounting, lawyers, you know, what my business model was. And after they got up off the floor laughing, you know, they said, hey, that's pretty interesting. I mean, the model was you meet somebody when they're 17 or 18 that's a potential player, and you kind of babysit them for about 10, 11 years until they make it. You know, in baseball, it takes 7 or 8 years to get out of the minor leagues. And so I became their mother and walked them through a lot of these things and, you know, stayed out of their way playing-wise, but helped them get coaching, helped them get tax advice, helped them get a phone, helped them get all these things. And then after time, the ones that made it and stayed healthy would pay off.
So you're like a baseball scout. A scout's looking for talent. You're out there sitting alongside the talent scouts for baseball looking for the same thing.
The first story – just what you described. One of my first days was in Port Charlotte, Florida. I'm dressed like this, only the suit's a little heavier, with a tie in July. It's about 105 degrees, and the humidity is about the same. And the scouts are sitting next to me, and they're laughing, and they're teasing me. They go, oh, would you leave the yacht out in the water and come on in for the day? I mean, and I fought back or teased back, and a couple of the guys from that became some of my best friends. I am a generalist. I'm a talker. You know, if I decide to do something, I'm going to do it. But as far as super skills, I don't really have any. So I would meet with baseball scouts and have them tell me who was good. It wasn't a talent I had. If I saw Ken Griffey Jr. or Craig Griffey right next to each other, I wouldn't know which was which. So, but over time, I made friends with people in all these different things, and one of them was this Joe Madden. He was probably 30 years old. He started as a water boy with the Anaheim Angels, worked 31 years with the Angels, worked himself up to bench coach, which was the assistant to the manager. Mike Socia was the manager with a 10-year contract, the former Dodger star. And Joe got an opportunity in 2006 to get a first-time opportunity to be a major league manager with the Tampa Bay Rays. The Tampa Bay Rays were a team that was born in 1998 as a gift for Major League Baseball. Both Phoenix and Tampa were given teams so that they wouldn't sue Major League Baseball for the strike of 1994. So they were awarded teams in 1994, and they began play in 1998. For the first 6 years, 7 years of the Tampa Bay Rays, they failed. They were in last place every time. They had an owner named Vince Namoli, was about the size of me, only much squarer, and he was depressed, and he'd walk down the hall depressed after every game, and everybody around was depressed. So that he sold this team to a bunch of men from New Jersey, dot-comers, real estate, hedge funds, brilliant guys, and they hired Joe Madden, and Joe Madden took that job, and within 2 years, they were in the World Series. Now, the problem was there. He's an amazing guy, and he took all these people and made them the best they could be.
And Joe Madden himself was not a successful player.
No,
he was a minor league player, right?
106 in rookie ball.
And he was a dismal baseball player, but brilliant manager.
Yeah, he was a walk-on from Lafayette College to the Angels. He lasted 2 years. He hit 106 in A-ball. And so he immediately started out with them as both water boy and associate scout. And he worked his way up from that point. So that would be a type of an example of my career. I met people at the bottom and just became friends with them. The players, it was more immediate payoff. But in this case, this guy just... And 2 years before he got the offer as the manager, he asked me if I'd represent him. So, you know, most of my business, I had to go run around the country, babysit, hold hands, get to know the mothers, make the transition from the mother to the girlfriend without getting fired. You know, I mean, all the things I did, you know, people laugh. They say, how much do you make? And it's 4% is what we make. And I say the reason is because that's about how much time we spend negotiating. The rest of the time we spend hand-holding, babysitting, making excuses, lurking around, waiting. And so with Madden, we waited 18, 19 years.
So the negotiating is what makes the movies, what makes the press, what people think about. What's that process like, negotiating? Take us inside the room. What's a typical negotiation look like?
Well, it'd be like any negotiation. If you have the leverage, you can act one way. If you don't have the leverage, you have to act another way. What do they say in the law? If you're a lawyer and the law is on your side, pound the law. If the facts are on your side, pound the facts. And if neither are on your side, pound the table. So essentially, that's about, you know, and I have a personality that I had to really subjugate for negotiating. Because in the beginning, you're representing young players. They don't have any leverage. You know, but I started this right at the beginning of sports agency. So I'd be arguing with these men that were minor league directors and assistant GMs for $50. And they'd humor me, and we'd argue for weeks and weeks, and then they'd say no, and that we'd move on. I'd tell my client I tried my best. You really don't have any influence until they get to arbitration, their third year of the major leagues. So what I started to do, because I had no leverage, was try to get longer deals for young players that the teams believed in so they would get a guarantee. And they would be out there for sure, because once the team's paying them, they're going to play them. And then we would find out. So I had a lot of luck with that. And that's kind of what we did with Joe in the first case. We could not negotiate with Tampa. They offered him a four-year deal, 2 years guaranteed at like $550,000 and $600,000. You know, the football coach at the University of Utah makes over $2 million. There's right. not a football coach in a big school in this country that doesn't make $2, $3 million. And these baseball managers, if you've noticed, the last five that were hired this year and the last three from last year were all brand-new rookies, mostly players who'd never managed. Now, that's odd to me. And when you looked at this year's playoffs, you see Matt Williams – with Washington, maybe the best team in the National League, boom, gone. He's standing there looking around. He's learning on the job. Same thing with the guy with Detroit, Brad Ausmus. They had a fabulous team, probably should have won it all. But they had a rookie manager. So Joe is now, with Tony La Russa retiring, Bobby Cox retiring, and they've both bumped themselves up into front office positions and even ownership of some of the clubs.
Let's go back into the business of it. You say 4%. So a typical sports agent's commission is in that neighborhood as a percentage of their contract?
You know, baseball allows us to do what we want. So there are people that charge five. There's people that charge three or two. In the other two sports, basketball and football, it's fixed. If it's a fixed amount, and I'm not sure of it, but it's four is on the high side. So that if you get a multi-year deal for a guy, you actually get a lower commission. And it's very stringent now, the rules of being a sports agent in basketball and in football. It's much more difficult.
Now, is it worth there are a few, and I remember Carl Malone in his early years negotiated directly with Larry Miller, didn't use an agent. There are some who think they can make their own best deal.
That seems silly to me to say 4%.
Is it kind of like a lawyer? You've got a fool for a client if you're going to, if you're an athlete and negotiate your own deal?
Well, the Karl Malone situation is classic. Karl Malone had an agent. He signed his rookie deal 4 years. He wasn't happy with it. He fired the agent. He still had to pay him. He then ended up getting a different guy who negotiated another four-year deal that after 1 year he wasn't happy with. So he fired the guy. He still had to pay him. And this happened three times. So then he went to Miller on his own and signed a lifetime contract. Karl Malone was one of the few that benefited when the league changed to a certain length of time and a salary cap, because he did a bad deal every single time, every time.
What about, Jerry Maguire is one of my favorite films. I've probably watched that a couple dozen times, and ironic because I'm not a huge sports fan, but it's just a great story and it's told well. How many players could you represent at a time? What was your max, and what was kind of your average?
Well, in the beginning, I would take anybody who would listen to me. My wife tells a story about being in Portland, Oregon. We stepped up to AAA that year because I was scouting around in the Midwest, in the Northwest League, and in the California League A ball. And I ended up trying to get somebody's attention, and I was hanging on a screen, waving at somebody I didn't know, asking them if they had an agent. So it's a goofy process. What I feel, say your question one more time, because I
was just curious, you know, the whole theme of Jerry Maguire is we're going to have fewer players we're going to represent, we're going to do a better job for them. So I'm curious, in your experience, how many players did you represent kind of at your max? Is it dozens or is it a handful?
I represented 110 players, 35 of them were in the big leagues.
Okay.
And it was by myself with one associate named Steve Alexander. And we took care of all of it. As I grew and had more people work for me, not good. Because they didn't work as hard as me and I wasn't a very good teacher.
Well, people are hiring you. They're not hiring some mythical firm.
Right.
It's definitely a relationship business, I would think.
It is. And what's hard about it now is people, they used to come and steal your player. I mean, imagine that. You know, you stole somebody from somebody. Now they come and steal your employee, who can then take 10 or 12 with them at once. And it's a fascinating business. And that's sort of what made me not want to do it anymore.
Well, and there's a huge incentive to steal players, right? Because it takes so long to cultivate somebody. You start off in the minor league, it takes years, And then somebody sweet talks a player and they bypass 7 years of hard work.
Well, because we're on a public radio station, I can't tell you some of the stories about what they'll do to steal. But it made me realize that my time is worth more than that, and that I was fortunate enough to do really well for 25 years. I represented 15 players who lasted more than 10 years in the big league. So they made good money, very few stars. But I decided that I was going to stop doing it, sold the company to this man, Alan Nero, who did all the work for Joe Madden in this case. The only jobs I did was talking to Joe. And once again, he is such a loyal, honest guy. He didn't want to leave. He wanted to stay where he was and made an offer to the club for half of what we got. He said, you go back to the club and ask for half of what this Cubs offer is, and if they do it, we'll stay in Tampa. And they didn't do it. And it was one of the happiest days of my life. He was very sad, but within a few moments, this Tampa thing unfurled. You can represent as many people as you're willing to put your time into, but it's about time and working with no guarantee that you're ever going to make anything.
Now you got mixed up and are fairly known for the Matt Harrington situation.
You've done your homework.
And this is a promising young player, grew up in poverty. You signed him, and we don't want to get too deep, but this ended up another agent stealing him. A major league club either reneging on a deal or I'm not sure how that all shook out. But in any event, through various circumstances, a promising young man represented by first you and then another agent,
Scott Boris,
turned down a $4 million guaranteed deal, held out so long that he never made it to the majors and ended up in minor league ball, didn't do well, and then the last I heard was working at a Costco.
That's it.
And his career was killed before it even started.
Let me fill in a few details. Is that okay?
Sure.
Do we have time?
Sure.
Well, it is true. In 98, I got 6 first-round picks, and in 2000, we got 7 first-round picks, so we had a group out there recruiting. This kid was an amazing pitcher. He's about 6'4", 6'5", lived in a little town called Palmdale, California. Palmdale makes San Bernardino look like Beverly Hills, okay? So poverty isn't even the answer. The father was a pool tile repairman, and the mother stocked shelves at Target. The father worked with the kid every day, and that's why the kid was good. The Rockies, okay, this is right after the Josh Hamilton incident, and then J.D. Drew. So players were asking for major league deals of $10 and $12 million. We asked for a minor league deal of $4.95 million, right in line with what it had been doing. And all these clubs got excited, especially the Colorado Rockies. So we made a deal with them ahead of time, which again isn't legal, but it's done every day. They were going, boy, we have the certainty we'll get our kid at a price we can take, and they liked me. And there was a writer involved named Tracy Ringoldsby, who I'll never forget. But anyway, in this case, where I made mistakes is you take a fish out of water, after a while, it's not going to be good for eating or swimming. This kid should not have sat out. He did play in these little games, but he wasn't in an organized setting. And he hurt his arm. Now, we got him a $5 million net ascertained value insurance policy for lack of skill. They don't even write them anymore. And eventually, he collected on that policy, but not under my regime. He was with me that year. We couldn't reach an agreement. By the end of the year, he was throwing 82, so the Rockies weren't going to comply. Theo Epstein, the one with that just signed Joe, had made a deal with me that they'd take him in the second round the next year. So they took him in the second round. All he had to do was go in and throw 92, and he'd get his money. If he threw 98, they'd give him even more. The kid couldn't do it. And when the parents and the kid found out I was willing to settle for a little less to get him playing, Scott Boris moved in, stole him away, and represented him for the next 6 years. So they held out for 6 more years under Scott Boris. I ended up suing the Rockies, Major League Baseball, Scott Boris, and a whole bunch of people. And the kid sued me. And
So you were talking about with the Rockies and that you couldn't come to a deal.
Right.
What does that process look like? There just was no middle ground? There wasn't common ground between what the kid was willing to take?
No, they saw just what your friend said. They saw that he was a poor kid. He lived in a home that had no wall coverings, a cinder block in and out, no floor coverings. So they made a promise of $4.95 million. And then when they saw where he lived, they said, we're not paying that. And I said, fine, you're not getting the kid. And they were behind me the whole way. I mean, you couldn't stop your client from taking the money.
You know, it's funny you say that because I think of American sports as it's the American dream. It doesn't matter what kind of house you come from. If you can throw the right type of pitch, you can make it to the minor leagues and have a shot at the major leagues. What did the Rockies care what kind of house the kid came from?
Because they knew they could sign him for less, and it was part of a deal by the league to bring the prices down. The fact is that you did your homework, and that was really a telling series of events in my life. It made me realize, one, hard to trust players. Number two, when parents are greedy and they see their child as a way to make money and get out of their mess, that's not good either. And I really should have pushed him to sign. It would have made a difference for him, a difference for me. But then I probably wouldn't be sitting here today. So, you know, you just kind of follow the ball. But I did learn my lesson.
So she's 25 years in the major leagues as an agent. Are you cynical about baseball? Can you sit and watch a game and thoroughly enjoy it or
it's
not?
It's taken about 5 or 6 years. I took about 5 or 6 years
you
off.
You had withdrawal?
No, it's just I love the game, but what I didn't like, I got to know so many people. And most of the people in baseball, and I'm sure I'm not going to make people happy, is the people that are in the charge never made it. So the people that are in charge that didn't make it are trying to get their piece of it, and they're doing it on the backs of the kids. They think we're doing it on the backs of the kids, but if you ask for a job description from me, I'm not only a babysitter, I'm a big brother. I'm a dad, I'm a banker, I'm a loan counselor, I'm a psychologist, I'm a, you know, financial advisor. All those things you have to do. And I loved doing it. Where I got cynical was the stealing, the lying, and the cheating. And yet a man like Joe Maddon, he brought me back.
So I see you brought in the paper here, so you're still quite the baseball fan. What do you miss the most about doing the job of an agent?
Nothing.
I miss none of it. Okay, good.
And yet
I still get,
this is the beauty of this. For here, this man gets a chance to take a team that hadn't won in 107 years and own a city. For me, I get to go and do and be what I want, but not really have to be in the nitty gritty. And at this stage of life, I like living in Park City.
Well, that's a good note to end on. Our guest is Tommy Tanzer. Not only is he a successful baseball agent, but you've got a great baseball name, Tommy Tanzer. Tommy, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tommy. We could talk baseball all day, but we won't.
We're going to talk soup next.
Instead, we'll talk food.
We've got Green Hillman in from Zupa's. Stay tuned. We'll be back. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Thank you to Tommy Tanzer for coming in and talking baseball with us. In studio now is Gene Hillman from Zupa's. Gene, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
For having me.
Now, Gene, you've been in business how long in Park City now with Zupa's?
You know, I think we opened, it's been a little over a year now up there.
And you're in the Redstone-Kimball Junction area.
Exactly.
There are a number of new franchises in that area. Are you holding your own? How's business been?
We feel like it's been going really well. People seem to really like what we've got there, and nice fresh offering and feel-good kind of food that you can have there. So it's been very good for us.
So I think I butchered your name there. Help me out. I've got a piece of paper here. I've got some Swedish accents above two E's. How do I pronounce your first name?
It's not hard to pronounce, but it's a little different. It's like green, but without the R, so it's Gein.
Gein, okay. Yeah, my apology, Gein. So, you know, Zupas seems to be sprouting up all over the state of Utah. How many stores do you have now?
We have 26 stores in Utah, Las Vegas, and Phoenix.
So it takes a lot of money to do that. Are you guys venture-backed, or is it the founders backing it, or how are you financing this rollout?
It's all corporate-owned. We do have some venture capital helping us out. But, yeah, we are going the corporate-owned method so we can kind of really control the quality of our product and the service we provide.
Okay, now you've changed up the product. When I dropped in there a year ago, it was good. It was all fresh made, healthy kind of food, soups, salads, sandwiches, and you've changed it up now after a year, right?
We have, yeah. In fact, it's been the biggest change we've made in the 10 years we've been in business. Our first restaurant started in Provo 10 years ago. And we've always done, since the beginning, house-made, meaning we make our soups from scratch in our kitchen right there on location. Our salads are all chopped up fresh right there. But we've made some nice improvements. We changed 9 of our 12 salads that we offer with some more upscale ingredients, some brand-new recipes for our dressings that we make in-house. And so it's kind of a big deal for us. 9 new salads out of the 12 are new.
That is a big shakeup. How do you think about the potential risk of doing that? What you have is working. Now you're going to make a major change.
Yeah,
and I can make a plug for your old menu. My family loves going there, so it's very good food. It's quality food at a reasonable price, which is fun to see.
Yeah, it's a good question. We actually have on our menus a guide for people to help them if they love the chicken, if they love one of the older salads, the piña colada, for example, then we can recommend the Maui tropical chicken, which is not terribly different, but it's upgraded, and we've got some fresh new ingredients on there, some reworked recipes, and so we did start testing this in Draper in September, and the response has been very well received, and so we decided just to roll that out to every single location.
So with upscale ingredients, that sounds like upscale in terms of pricing, too. Are you priced the same, or did you improve but need to then cover costs by raising prices?
You know, we haven't raised our prices in those 10 years. We did have to make a few cents difference on these new salads. It's a negligible 10 or 20 cents on the salads that we increased, but the value has gone up tremendously, and part of that reason is, and it kind of goes contrary to what people most people think when they see a company expand, they think that their quality will tend to go down. We've got better buying power now and are able to negotiate with our suppliers higher end ingredients, and so we want to put that buying power to use and make some improvements.
So there's a couple of things that come with growth, right? One is maintaining the quality, not just of the food, but also of the service and the experience. Retail's hard. Running a restaurant's really, really hard. When you walk into a restaurant, it's funny. You can tell almost instantly, if you're looking for it, how well-run the operation is.
Very good point.
As you guys grow, your first store was in Provo. I've never been to that location, but clearly they were doing some things right because you can see it out here in Park City as far as how the operations go. How did you maintain that core and transfer over that operational skill and process as you grew?
Very good question. Yeah, since I've been here for 4 years, when I started, we had 7 locations. And so we've grown quickly in those past 4 years. And, I'm VP of marketing, but most of what I spend my time doing is helping with our training efforts. So it's a very big recruiting and training effort that we have to go through. And we expect a lot from our employees. A lot of them might be their first job, but we expect them to memorize all the salads and represent the brand in a positive way. So it's a lot of training goes into it. And just good management, finding good managers. We're always looking for good management level people to join the team.
You know, when I drive around this city and others, and I see Zupa's Barbacoa was in a few years ago, Cafe Rio, Baja Fresh. There, it seems like everything new that's opening up in the last decade has avoided all things fried. Is that the case? I mean, even Kentucky Fried Chicken will call itself KFC, so they don't have to say the word fried.
Exactly.
And I think McDonald's has struggled a little bit in the last few years. Is frying on its way out as a fast food option?
I think so. I don't know what a lot of those, you know, companies that do primarily fried food will do, but that's never been our thing. In fact, we don't have a fryer in our restaurant at all. So it's a trend that plays well to our favor. I don't know if it was a trend 10 years ago when we started, but the whole idea of Cafe Zupa is this, I mean, we want to make food that people could eat several times a week with and feel good about themselves, you know, doing it, and get kind of a better than home-cooked meal that because it's been, you know, really good recipes. We kind of compare the quality of our food to more full-service kind of restaurants, but we just are able to deliver it in a quick way. So we call it quick service.
So, Gene, you were talking earlier about the importance of training. And part of that is the folks that you hire. And Park City's, especially this time of year, it's really hard to hire people, right? Because you're competing with the resorts as well. What do you do to differentiate yourself and attract the people you need to?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. In fact, our wages in Park City have to be higher than the rest of the state across the Wasatch Front. So we have to pay more up in Park City for the talent. You're right, it is very hard. We're always, in fact, you know, shout out to anybody who wants a good job. We're not open on Sundays. We don't have a fryer, so that's a benefit to a lot of people.
You don't go home smelling like fried food.
Exactly. It's a great, fun atmosphere and tons of opportunity for growth in the company. So,
well, Gene, that's a great answer. I like hearing that you're paying a higher wage up here. It's an important thing. This is an expensive place to live, and we thank the folks in our community that do work in the service industry. It's mm-hmm. the backbone, really, of what makes Park City tick. Gene, thank you for joining us. Our guest has been Gene Hillman from Zupa's out at Kimball Junction. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we will be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We want to start off thanking our guest this morning, Scott Elbin, author of Overworked and Overwhelmed. That sounds like a book that's worthwhile reading. It's definitely something that we all struggle with. And then Tommy Tanzer, who is a business manager, not a business manager, but a talent agent for Major League Baseball players. That was actually really interesting.
And yeah, we didn't get into a million other topics you could get into on the subject of pro sports, steroids, and all the rest. And
we should have him back in. I enjoy chatting with him.
It's always fun for me, especially, to talk
about.
And
then our final guest was Gene Hillman. Gene, again, sorry for not pronouncing your name properly.
I've never seen that name ever.
Gene Hillman from Zupa's, paying a higher wage than what they pay elsewhere in the state. So check it out if you're looking for a position.
Indeed. And next week on Mountain Money, we've got a really sharp author, Nathan Furr, will be in with us, a friend of Doug's, actually. The foreword is by Clayton Christensen, who's a rock star on the business faculty of Harvard.
Innovator's Dilemma. He was a famous author.
And this book is The Innovator's Method, Bringing the Lean Startup into Your Organization. So that will be our star attraction next week. I want to thank our great sponsors, the Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Larry, if we have time, we should thank the audience, too, for the great support of Live PC, Give PC this past Friday.
I thank you for reminding me, because I had it on the list. We just rocked
Doug. You did rock.
We did great, and I want to thank the 300 donors who called in Friday and made it a record day for us. Really appreciate it. This is KPCW Park City, headed to a high of 42 today, and it's time now for NPR News.